Well, good morning, everybody. Please be seated. Joining me are Justice Nancy Sata, Justice Mark Gibbons, in what we used to refer to as the Northern Panel, but we just call it the Gibbons-Sata-Cherry Panel from now on. Our first case this morning is a case 52333, Brooks versus State. And Mr. Erickson for the appellant and Danielle Piper for the respondent. Welcome to all the attorneys that are sitting at the tables. Mr. Erickson, you ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
Would you like to reserve any time?
Yes, Your Honor, I would request to reserve 5 minutes.
That'll be the order.
May it please the Honorable Court, I am Tom Erickson representing Gary Brooks, the appellant in this matter, and on behalf of Mr. Brooks, do appreciate the opportunity to address the court on what I think are some significant legal issues that were brought up from this trial. There are three issues that we raised in the appellate materials. The first being the evidence of what is believed to be a prior false sexual accusation being excluded from the trial. As the justices are aware, the trial attorney attempted to introduce both testimony of CPS workers and CPS documents showing that the main complaining witness, the defendant's daughter, Danielle, had made accusations about 2 months after Mr. Brooks was arrested that another child in custody or in the CPS custody had touched her in an inappropriate sexual way. The state argues, to begin with, that this was not a prior false or not a prior accusation, and it is our position that this accusation clearly was prior to Mr. Brooks' trial, and Danielle later acknowledged to the CPS workers that she was joking about the accusations, is the language that comes from the trial record. That joking, or in our opinion, false accusation of sexual contact with another individual is clearly relevant to this child's propensity to either seek attention or for whatever reason make accusations against somebody about something very serious. We think that the trial court's determination that this was not prior to Mr. Brooks being arrested is not a point that in any way distinguishes the admissibility or the significance or relevance of that information. We feel that under the cases of Abbott, which is the 2006 Nevada Supreme Court case, Efren versus State, a 1991 decision, and the older decision, Sheriff versus Franks, 1987, all of those cases stand for the proposition that a defendant has the right to present to a jury prior false accusations of sexual conduct that a complaining witness has made. And because Mr. Brooks was not able to present that very critical information in his trial, we believe that he did not receive a fair and constitutionally mandated trial, and on that basis alone, the trial court's decision, our verdict should be overturned and he should be granted a new trial.
Mr. Erickson, if we find it to be error, why isn't it harmless error?
Your Honor, the vast majority of the charges that he was convicted of are based almost primarily on the testimony of this 15-year-old witness, and her credibility is at the heart of those accusations, and we believe that without the trial or without the jury knowing of this very important issue, that there's no way that it can be found that it is harmless error, that her credibility is central to most of the charges upon which he was convicted, and we think that fundamentally he deserves to be able to challenge her credibility.
Notwithstanding the fact that credibility presented in the manner that you're suggesting is a bit different than the credibility that takes place in the examination and cross-examination of a witness. Nonetheless, isn't it true that the jury had an opportunity to see this witness, to view this witness, and to determine whether or not she should or could be believed?
Yes, Your Honor. I certainly agree with that. But without the evidence of her making a contemporaneous false accusation against another person about sexual misconduct and her later acknowledging that she was joking about that, it's our position that that is so fundamentally material that that had to be presented to the jury to allow him to present a full defense.
I'm not certain I disagree with you, frankly. I just wanted to be sure that I was reading this the right way, that there was, in fact, an ample opportunity for this witness to be examined.
And it's our position that there wasn't, without being able to cross-examine her on that issue. The second area that we challenge is the claims under NRS 200.508, which is the child abuse and neglect charges. And it is briefed, I think, fairly fully that the evidence that was presented was insufficient for a jury to find that Danielle either suffered or was placed in a position to possibly suffer harm or mental anguish sufficient to justify the conviction under those charges. There was no, as you're aware, the evidence that was presented was that she was placed in a situation where she allegedly saw her father beginning to have sex with a prostitute and smoking illegal substances with another prostitute. That is what the allegations in the information alleged. Now, in the state's response, they also bring up the allegation that her father had forced her to ingest illegal substances. Now, that was never charged in the information, and we certainly don't feel that is a basis where it wasn't charged to support the conviction under the abuse and neglect charges. We think that it is under the allegations that were made, it required beyond the 15-year-old's testimony that she did or could have suffered either physical or mental abuse under the situation that she was placed in. And then the last area is the insufficiency of the specificity for the sexual assault charges. This is an area where there's quite a bit of case law outlining, and generally we certainly understand that the prosecution is not required to list the exact date of allegations. But in this case, where it is such a broad range, over a 10-year period, where the allegations were that 2 to 3 times a week, for basically a 10-year period, that this young lady claims that she was sexually assaulted by her father, is too broad. There are two specific instances where she gives details. The rest is a very, very broad and generic allegation from her, in which Mr. Brooks, there is no way that he can defend against 10 years of 2 to 3 times a week. We have cited to a Montana decision that certainly is not binding on this court, but I think under constitutionally required ability for a defendant to defend himself requires that where there is a broad time period alleged, that the jury be given a jury instruction that there has to be a unanimous decision or verdict on a specific instance. We did not have that here. We had such a large time period for most of the sexual assault charges that we feel he did not have the opportunity to properly defend himself, and that by not requiring a specific finding from the jury as to an instance that the jurors were finding him guilty of, that violated his constitutional rights. And we believe that there should be a requirement where there is such a broad time period alleged that the jurors have to unanimously find the instance or determine the instance upon which they're basing a conviction.
Want to save your 6 minutes?
Yeah, unless you have further questions, yes.
Justice Gibbons, Justice Sada? No?
Thank you.
Ms. Piper, on behalf of the district attorney.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Danielle Piper, and I am here on behalf of the Clark County District Attorney's Office for the respondent. I'm not sure if you want me to take the allegations 1, 2, 3, or do 3, 2, 1.
Well, I'd like to have the one, the first one.
In regard to the prior false allegation, what I'd like to do is sort of give the court a context of the way this came up.
Please do.
On the day of calendar call, May 15, 2008, the defense filed a motion for witnesses. He was going to call additional witnesses. The state objected to the filing because it was not within the statutory time period. It was not 5 days prior to trial. Judge Herndon at that point asked the defense for a proffer. Why is it that you want to call these CPS workers? And defense counsel at that time, Mr. Walton, said, I want to bring in because in October of 2006, there was an incident where Danielle's brother, Gary Brooks, had been hit by the defendant in the face. At that time, CPS was able to talk to both Danielle as well as Gary Brooks. In the notes from CPS from the October 2006, Danielle talks about how her father, when she was 5 years old, touched her. That's initially what Mr. Walton wanted to bring in. He then said that there was an incident that happened on October 27, 2007, after Danielle had been taken into custody, after both the defendant and Danielle had been taken into custody, and Danielle had gone to child prison. There was an incident between Danielle and another girl. Mr. Walton at that time never categorized or never sort of said that that was a prior false allegation. He wasn't even sure if he wanted that information in. What Mr. Walton wanted in at the time of trial was the October 2006, where Danielle had not said to CPS anything more than, when I was 5 years old, my father touched me. Judge Herndon then asked us to give him the CPS records. We then started the trial. The state objected to bringing in this information because we felt it was not relevant. It wasn't going to explain away any information for the court or for the jury. What Judge Herndon allowed the defense to do was get into the October 2006, where all Danielle said to CPS was, my dad touched me when I was 5 years old, and that's all I said to them. In regard to the incident that happened subsequent to the arrest of the defendant as well as Danielle being taken into custody, Judge Herndon said it doesn't explain anything, it doesn't explain away any physical findings, it doesn't explain any way the sexual assault allegations. All it was something that happened at Child Haven between Danielle and another girl. It wasn't even substantiated. We didn't even know if it was an accusation at that point. It was just some CPS reports that said that there might have been a touching or there was some joke that went on. The girls then were all disciplined. They were told not to write notes and not to gossip. So at the time of the trial, it was never a prior false allegation. That wasn't the way it was presented to the court. What Mr. Walton wanted to get into was another incident that happened in 2006, and that's what he was allowed to bring up. The appellant's attorney brings up Franks, and he talks about the Franks case. In the Franks case, the allegations were that the victim made against her neighbor, her brother, as well as her dad. At a proceeding prior to the grand jury, because the case was taken to the grand jury, at a proceeding prior in juvenile hall, the victim recanted her allegations against, I think it was, her brother and the neighbor. The state then proceeded to the grand jury, and in the grand jury, that prosecutor chose not to bring in any of the allegations in regard to the neighbor and the brother, but did bring in the allegations with the defendant. That's not the same case that we have here. We do not have any type of hearing. We don't have anything where there's an accusation that Danielle made. We don't even know whether it was false or not. There was never any Miller hearing held. There was never any motion filed that would give the state notice that the defense intended to do this. All we knew was that he filed a motion because he wanted to bring in some witnesses. We then inquired into that information. There was never any type of allegation that we knew about. And the information that Mr. Walton actually wanted to get into in the trial, the October 2006, he was allowed to question Danielle about.
So you would, I guess you, and I use the word concede, not to put you in any corner, though, but if in fact there were a prior false sexual allegation in a sexual assault case, that's admissible under Franks?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. But, you know, obviously the state would contend that we need to have a Miller hearing, there needs to be a motion filed, so then we're then on notice. But in regard to this case, that's not what we had.
And Walton never filed any Miller motion or anything like that?
No, Justice Sherry, he never filed anything. All we got was a notice of witnesses that was filed on the calendar call day, which was May 15th, 2008. And that's where the state then started to inquire, as well as the judge, why do you want to, you know, why are you, one, filing it so late? And two, you know, why do you want to get into this? At the time, obviously, Judge Herndon made the record that if they were prior false allegations, even though there was a statutory requirement that they be given 5 days ahead of time, under Miller, there's no time frame. So basically, Judge Herndon said that if these are prior false allegations, he will be allowed to bring them in. But at that time, it was never characterized that way. And so he was allowed to bring in part of what he wanted to, but not the other part, which he, at the time, if you read the transcript, he wasn't that concerned about. In regard to the child abuse count, you know, if you look at NRS 200.508, part of the statute talks about where the child may suffer physical pain or mental suffering as a result of abuse or neglect. And the state in its information charged picking up prostitutes and or engaging in sexual activity in the presence of Danielle. If you look at Danielle's testimony, that would be volume 2. If you look at page 303 to 307, it's May 20th, 2008. Danielle testifies about how after they left the Red Rooster, they were driving down Fremont Street. When she was driving down Fremont Street, they saw a lady. Her dad then drove around twice. Her dad then pulled over to the side and spoke to the lady. Danielle kept calling her a hooker. The woman approached the vehicle. The woman then asked Danielle's father, and later we find out it's an undercover vice cop, engage in some conversation. What the defendant says at that point, or appellant says to the vice cop, is that he wants to have a threesome, that he wants to have his daughter as well as the vice cop engage in some sexual activity. He then explains how he wants the vice cop, or what he wants this vice cop to teach Danielle to do, and what he wants Danielle to do to this vice cop. It's at that point that the vice cop looks at Danielle and looks at the appellant and says, is she working? Because she can't figure out whether it's a juvenile prostitute or who is in the vehicle with the appellant. I'm sorry, were you going to ask me a question?
No.
It's at that point the defendant then negotiates a price. The vice cop says, how's about $80? And the defendant says, or the appellant says, I can't pay $80 because I had to feed her at Wendy's and we went to the Red Rooster and got turned away. It's at that point that they then negotiate a price of $20. The vice cop then sort of points to an area where she wants the defendant to park, and it's at that time once the appellant pulls over and parks, vice then immediately surrounds the vehicle. The defendant tells Danielle, say that this is a joke. Danielle says that. She then sees her father put into custody, and it's within a short period of time that she then tells Detective Benjamin the things that the defendant has been doing to her. So in the information, we talk about picking up prostitutes. That's one time he picked up a prostitute. Danielle's testimony, and that's in volume 2, page 336 to 340, she talks about how the appellant picked up a prostitute by the name of Shaggy, how they were driving near the Stratosphere. They then had Shaggy get in the car with them. They then went over to a house or an apartment-type building near the Stratosphere. They consumed some narcotics. The appellant tells Danielle to take off her clothes. She then refuses to do so. Danielle then sees appellant, her father, remove his clothes and then remove Shaggy's clothes, and then they start to kiss, and Danielle makes a comment, I didn't want to stand there and watch what they were going to do because I had been there prior and had seen my dad do something. It's then that she testifies about a time in the same summer, 2007, and this is going to be on volume 2, page 341, where her dad then comes into contact with someone by the name of Diamond, or I think they call her Crystal. That they go to Diamond or Crystal's house, that she's a prostitute, they consume some narcotics, She then sees her dad take off Crystal's clothes, her father, the appellant, and takes off his clothes, and then she sees Diamond lie on her back. The appellant, her father, then gets on top of Diamond, and they start to have sex, and Danielle walks out of the room. In regard to proving that charge beyond the reasonable doubt, the respondent would submit to you that the defendant picking up three prostitutes in front of his daughter and or engaging with sexual activity in front of his daughter on the two charges, or on the two times with Shaggy and Crystal, that we've proven that beyond a reasonable doubt. In regard to the information, initially what happened is we filed a criminal complaint in this case. We then met with Danielle and an amended criminal complaint was filed. At the time of the preliminary hearing, the testimony, Danielle got up and she gave testimony. And Danielle, the way we tied each of these sexual assault counts and the lewdness counts to where she lived. Danielle could remember that twice when she was 5 years old, appellant touched her over her clothes. She then remembers that when she was 10 years old is when he started to have sex with her, and we tied those to the homes that she lived in. At the end of the preliminary hearing, let me back up and say this. The amended criminal complaint, in the top part of it, it alleged a broad range. In regard to each count that we alleged, there was a date range, a specific date range. At the end of preliminary hearing and after Danielle had testified, the state then moved to, in the individual counts, remove the date. And we brought that up at the end, or counsel at the time brought that up. The judge then asked Mr. Walton, counsel for the appellant at the time, do you have any objection to removing the date? And he said no. The defendant was there at the preliminary hearing. So was appellant's attorney at that time, Mr. Walton. He was there. He did not object at all to those dates being removed in regard to the individual count. We then got up to the trial level, and information was filed, and then amended information, and both of them left out count six, which is why we then had a second amended information, which was filed on October 15, 2007. On October 23, 2007, is when the defendant was actually arraigned in front of a district court. At that time, the defendant never objected to not having any sufficiency, not having any information. We then proceeded to trial. There was never any objection in regard to that the defendant could not defend against these charges. We then proceeded to trial, and the defendant was then convicted of the charges. So at no time was this issue raised prior to coming to this court. So the state, you know, and looking at the information that we have, and it's my understanding that the case that rules is Laney versus State, and the test there is the indictment or the information standing alone must contain the elements of the offense intended to be charged and must be sufficient to appraise the accused of the nature of the offense so that he may adequately defend. In this case, after sitting through the preliminary hearing, we tied each of the accusations to homes or places where Danielle lived. The last two accusations of sexual assault under 16, Danielle testified happened at the Raven Horse house that she lived in when the defendant was arrested. And then she also talked about a ravine, an area where near the Raven Horse house that the defendant had sexual relations. I'm sorry, was I going to interrupt you?
No.
So each of the counts we alleged, we tied to some type of home, and then her mother testified as to the year that each of those things were the homes that they had lived in. And Danielle testified in regard to when she was 5 years old, the lewdness counts.
Ms. Piper, what about the argument that the judge should have sua sponte given a unanimity instruction?
I'm not sure how to answer that. I think that if the allegation had been, and one of the things that Danielle testified to in this case was that once she was 10 years old, her dad sexually assaulted her for 2 to 3 times a week from 10 to 15 years old. Mm-hmm. But we also got specific testimony in regard to homes that this happened at and instances that we haven't had. She testified about most of these individually. I think if you have an allegation where it's happening over a long period of time where it's very general, then I think that instruction is appropriate. But here where the victim can actually specifically tie down what home or her age or the area in which it happened, I think it's difficult for a child in a sexual assault case where the abuse is happening over a long period of time to find that type of unanimity because they're children. At 10 years old, she's not going to understand, and of course it's not her burden, it's the state's burden to show that, but it's difficult to do at best with those types of cases.
And counsel did not propose that instruction?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Anything else, Justice Gibbons, Justice Seda?
No.
Thank you, Ms. Piper.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Erickson, you have about 6 minutes left.
Thank you. There are some issues I want to address. One of the things that counsel mentioned was with the issue of the prior false accusations was that those would not in any way refute physical findings. Now, I just want to make it clear that from my reading of the record, and I'm at a little disadvantage because I was not the trial attorney on this, and I'm just going off of what's in the record. I wasn't there to calendar call things of that nature, so some of the stuff that was brought up here timing-wise is somewhat new to me. But it's my understanding there were no physical findings introduced whatsoever that were suggestive or physical findings, period. So just to be clear, I think the record indicates there were no physical findings related to sexual assault examinations on this young lady. The issue of what Mr. Walton had brought up at calendar call and his motion, the record that we have indicates that, and this is from Mr. Brooks' appendix, page 323, lines 1 through 7, is that he sought to introduce the CPS witnesses and records that would show that Danielle was in Child Haven and accused another girl of touching her breasts and then later admitted that she had just been joking about the accusation. And then the court's decision came later in the record. It's Brooks Appendix, page 368, lines 2 through 16. And it's my understanding that the basis of Judge Herndon's decision is that the court determined that since it happened after the alleged improprieties by Brooks, it was a collateral issue and inappropriate to bring up in front of the jury. And consequently, the evidence was excluded. It's my understanding of the record that Judge Herndon, an important focal decision for him was the timing of this allegation, that because it came after he was arrested, that it was not relevant. It is our position that under the cases, that it was a prior accusation to the trial, and it is relevant to the issue of credibility of this complaining witness, and as such, the fact that it was 2 months after he was arrested, it still is relevant and should have been allowed at the trial. So I do not believe that it's accurate to say that the issue of the false allegations was not raised to the trial judge. And it's our position both under the Efrain case and the constitutional requirements of a fair trial that the Miller hearing at a minimum should have been held and those CPS workers outside of the presence of the jury could have been examined, and at that point the judge could have determined the relevance and the materiality of the testimony.
Did counsel ask for a Miller hearing?
Your Honor, it's our position that the way that he phrased this, that he did, that he was trying to introduce evidence of the prior false accusation of a sexual crime against her, of a lewdness charge that she claimed that she had experienced at Child Haven, but then recanted and said that she was just joking about that accusation. I think that the other issues have been addressed as far as Justice Gibbons' question about the jury instruction on the based on the lack of specificity of these dates, I would just again reiterate it's our position that even if defense counsel did not request it, that in order to have a fair trial, the judge should have required that the jury make a specific finding as to events that the jury was basing those convictions on.
So we have to ask our district judges to be a bit clairvoyant and to create instances in the record where they stop, say, well, is this a false allegation of prior sexual misconduct? I'm not sure that I want to go that far.
Your Honor, I would direct you to the appendix. It's our position that the way that it was phrased from Mr. Walton, it clearly indicated that he was alleging a false accusation.
But there's a procedure. The whole Miller process is designed around this particular issue, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And if I went back to those appendix and looked for exact language that would draw the attention of the district judge to such a request, would it be there?
Yes, Your Honor. And it's at 323, lines 1 through 7, is where Mr. Walton makes outlines what he's wanting to introduce through the CPS records and the CPS witnesses.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions?
No.
Thank you very much. Panel thanks both counsel for their arguments and briefs in this matter. This case will stand submitted, and we just...